This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Normal police detective Nicole Bruno says consent education should focus on what sexual assault is rather than what it is not.
We've heard everything from, well, if they were flirting at the bar beforehand, then it wasn't a sexual assault. Well, it turned into a sexual assault the minute there was no consent.
Mary Cullen reports it's often difficult to change minds on the definition of consent. Plus, GLT's Eric Stock takes you inside the tired life of a snowplow driver. Connect Transit considers a new fare increase. And Normal Mayor Pro Tem Jeff Fritzen drops by to talk about community pushback to a new fire station proposed at Shepherd and Hershey Roads. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The town of Normal has moved ahead on an east side location for a new fire station at Shepherd and Hershey Roads, in spite of significant pushback from neighbors in the area. Joining us to talk about that and other developments is Mayor Pro Tem Jeff Fritzen. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Chris Koos is out of town today. Jeff Fritzen, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas. Would you respond to neighborhood concerns about a fire station at Hershey and Shepherd and the smaller lot sizes the development will have as a result?
This particular issue is multifaceted. So there's a gut reaction right away from a neighborhood, which is expected and, you know, quite frankly, a normal thing, I think, to learn of something that's going to be different than what you thought it was going to be when you relocated to that neighborhood or invested in a new home in a neighborhood and the like. So I can understand that. But the idea of the fire station was one thing that people were responding to. The other was, in order to carve out that property for the fire station, the developer who has developed the neighborhood where the people reside who are up in arms about the issue, there's another part to that development to the north that is to date undeveloped. There's a concept plan out there that showed how the developer intended to continue his development of that property with some R2 zoning, which is, we used to call them duplexes. You know, there's zero lot line now, but two homes connected together and. They already developed a lot of that along Shepherd Road, and they showed that's what was going to be along Hershey Road as well. And then to the north, in the larger part of the yet-to-be-developed part of the subdivision, the intention was to build more homes similar to what had already been built in the southern part. You know, the reaction then from the neighborhood, like I said, was, one, you're going to build a fire station right there, and then, two, they're going to change what I thought was going to be to my north and maybe make some lot sizes smaller and the like. And so I think the first thing in my years in public service when people respond in deep angst about something like that, you have to let them let it out, let them talk and not try to solve the problem for them in that first that initial conversation, because you're not going to. You're just not going to. You have to get to the root of the discord and kind of work back, through it to see where can we find some understanding and then work from there. And so I think that's what, even though the emotions are pretty deep in this neighborhood, I think that's what the process allowed to happen, the planning commission process and coming before the council and the staff hearing, the developer hearing some of the concerns from the neighborhood and making some adjustments along the way.
Is the heat and the concern all related to the town and the fire station, or is some of it perhaps displacement over promises made and then changed by the developer himself?
Oh, yeah. There's a good degree of that with the developer. And, you know, the town is kind of the lightning rod because, you know, we have the proposal for the fire station, which is a hard thing and something easy to look at and say, you know, here's how that's going to impact me. The rest of it is still on paper. So you can look at that and say, well, if they build smaller homes, that's going to affect the value of my home. If they change the layout of the streets, that's going to affect traffic patterns, we think. You know, and so the developer, though, they bought the property in 2009. They have a 20-year window with a development plan to develop that property. Along the way, though, markets change. And we all know that the market in Bloomington Normal for a lot of things, but real estate in particular, is shaken up by some of the changes with our largest employer.
And so current homeowners are out there and not seeing it develop as they had hoped.
Right, right.
And that also feeds into their feelings about this.
And so the developer, this is an opportunity for them to take a second look at the yet-to-be-developed portion and say,
what works
are
now?
We meeting the market that exists today and that we anticipate will exist, you know, over the next 10 years? So plans are drawn. You know, changes are not inevitable necessarily, but there's always that possibility. And that's what some of the fight is about.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us is Jeff Fritzen, the senior council member for the town of Normal, and Mayor Pro Tem at last night's meeting in the absence of Mayor Chris Koos. One of the things that was advanced last night that didn't go anywhere from council members Kathleen Lorenz and Scott Preston was the idea of maybe taking a look at a different corner of that intersection. Why didn't that carry any freight with you?
Several reasons. One, the practical nature of it is I don't know that it would really answer any of the concerns over the fire station location. The concerns being the aesthetics of it, or the supposed noise that will come with it and the like. Any of those corners of the intersection, those things aren't going to change. You're still going to have to see it, look at it. I anticipate we'll build an attractive building as best you can with a municipal, you know, building of that nature.
And that concern would diminish.
Right. Yeah. And noise-wise, we've determined really that hasn't been an issue, and we can adjust. You know, the fire department has indicated how, you know, procedurally they can make some adjustments to make sure they aren't causing any disturbance beyond what's necessary.
They don't roll the sirens right out of the door.
Right. And so I looked at that and think, I'm not accomplishing anything in that regard. The other aspect of that is the properties to the west, the corners, the northwest corner and the southwest corner of that intersection, those are zoned commercial, and there has been commercial development in those areas, although there's a lot of vacant land there, obviously. But, you know, you have in Menards, you have a Sam's Club, you have things of that nature out there. Do we want to spend more money because commercially zoned property is going to have a higher price tag than the residentially zoned property that we ultimately are going to purchase? So we'd be spending more money, but we'd also be taking that property out of the commercial inventory. You know, and so, yeah, commercial development is slow right now. There's not much going on. But in Normal, with Veterans Parkway access, there's not a lot of property, developable property out there. These are developable lots that have that. And so why would we want to take that out of inventory? The southeast corner of that intersection also is zoned commercial, but it has no improvements on it. There's no infrastructure. There's no water or sewer there. So the cost of developing that quadrant of the intersection would be even greater, not only for the land cost, but for the infrastructure that would have to be developed. So when you mix all that together, the northeast corner is the one that makes the most sense. One, because of the price tag, but two, as part of the subdivision, there's a nature trail or a walking trail, and a pond there that the town maintains, and it's zoned institutional zoning, not S2 zoning, which is what the fire station will have. So putting another S2 use next to an existing one made some sense. That trail and the like also provides a buffer, so to speak, between it, the station, and the residential part of the neighborhood. Right. And because we maintain it, because our Parks and Recreation folks are on site there and the like, you know, we can do some things with natural tree plantings and things like that that I think will provide even a greater buffer between the fire station and the homes. I don't know that we can ever eliminate somebody's dissatisfaction with the action, but I think we can mollify it to some degree by being good neighbors. And we've said we're going to be good neighbors, and people can hold us to that. There will be a site plan review. You know, there will be a building design with showing, you know, the landscaping and everything else for the fire station. And people will have an opportunity, again, in a public hearing to comment on the site plan. And we have said we want to be good neighbors. We need a fire station on the east side, so let's work together and try to make this, you know, make this the best we can. And I think that's where we'll end up, I think, eventually.
Before the council meeting last night, the council toured the new addition to Colleen House. How do you think that is an example of intergovernmental amity?
Well, on a couple of fronts. One, you know, we in the last couple of years have attempted to work more closely with Unit 5. And I kind of a little aside is I've been at it a long time, and one would think that it would be just a natural thing for different governmental bodies to be tuned into each other closely and know what each other's needs are and what each other's ambitions are and what each other has cooking at the moment. But the fact of the matter is the detail of running a school district, of running a town, of running a university, any of those types of entities is so great that the interaction, really, you have to be very intentional to get any kind of interaction. So we have tried to be more intentional in the last couple of years. We have intergovernmental agreements with Unit 5 where we can use facilities for Parks and Rec and the like, and we do work together on a regular basis that way, but we've tried to go to a little bit higher level. You know, we have a committee that meets occasionally. We had a joint meeting last year, I think it was, and those things were great and kind of set the stage for this. But I think the invitation from Unit 5 to us to say, we want to show you what we've done here, is an outgrowth from those efforts. It's them saying, hey, we're doing something here that I think is great. You know, we think is great for our community, and we want you to be aware of it, because we can. That way, being aware helps, because in a conversation I might have somewhere down the road with somebody, I know what's going on with Unit 5 when it comes to some special needs children. The other half of it is, years ago when subdivisions were really rampant in the community, we enacted an ordinance that said if you're going to build a subdivision, you have to pay an impact fee, a school impact fee. We've had it for Parks and Recreation, and we had it for water detention, but we didn't have it for schools. And Unit 5 was feeling the pinch of all this growth, and so we implemented a school impact fee. We had funds in that set aside that we were able to convey to Unit 5 to help pay for this. So, you know, the outreach and the interaction on one thing, and the other is financially we were able to have a stake in it and help Unit 5 accomplish this.
And it goes some length to make up for the complete lack of communication that resulted in the site placement of Normal Community High School on a green grass site at the far edge of the town that still has gaps in development.
Yeah. And that's, you know, our development was running rampant for a period of time, and it looked like we were just going to grow right out there and it was going to be connected. And by now, the expectation was, I'm sure, in the part of a lot of developers and many others in town, that would all be built up out there and it would look like it's just a natural part of the town. But yeah, like you said, there are still gaps, and unfortunately, and we'll adjust. You know, the market forces you to adjust at some point in time to those things, and And we'll see. It's just not just didn't happen as fast as we all anticipated it would.
One thing that the council did last night that got no public play at all because it was on the consent agenda, a non-controversial item, is, I think, worth mentioning here. The town approved an agreement with Greyhound Bus Lines, increasing the multi and the multimodal part of Uptown Station. Greyhound is going to be starting a north-south route going up closer to Rockford and further south on 55 after it hits the Twin Cities. How much does that increase the utility of the transfer point at Uptown Station?
Well, it remains to be seen. The presumption is Greyhound's doing it because they've done market studies and they anticipate that there's enough ridership there to make it a profitable route for them. So you have to rely on their expertise and their research to determine that this is a good service to bring in. But the idea of the multimodal center was to provide a hub, for the train traffic, the local bus system, and the over the road bus systems. And I think it's been a smashing success, and it creates traffic in Uptown Normal, which is one reason we wanted it located there. Foot traffic, pedestrian traffic, visitor traffic. It does create other traffic on the streets and the roads and whatever, but I think it's just a natural addition, to the facility and why the facility was built and to provide those options for people. So, there are other bus lines running in and out of there on a regular basis, and Greyhound is, one of those iconic companies in the United States when it comes to transportation, and so I think it's a good addition. And it's a 1-year agreement, so they're going to test the waters and whatever. But we already have the ticketing agents there, and you're really making more efficient use of the resources you already have by adding that that option.
Jeff Fritzen is Mayor Pro Tem and the senior sitting council member for the Town of Normal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Charlie.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next week, we'll hear from Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, performing Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite, Sibelius's Fifth Symphony, and Nielsen's Clarinet Concerto with Chicago Symphony's John Bruce Yeh. Friday, 7:30, January 25th at the BCPA. Details at ilsymphony.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Mary Cullen reports on misconceptions about consent and sexual assault. Connect Transit General Manager Isaac Thorne says the agency has held the line on fares as long as possible. For the first time in 12 years, Connect Transit is proposing a route restructuring that would take effect in July to help offset rises, a rate restructuring that would help offset rises in wages and inflation. He outlines the proposed changes with GLT's Eric Stock following a Connect Transit board meeting.
What we're proposing is increasing the one-way fare for fixed route from $1 to $1.25. And then that would increase the Connect Mobility one-way fare from $2 to $2.50. Then we also increase the Connect Mobility fixed route 30-day pass from $32 to $36, and then the CM Connect Mobility 30-day pass would increase from $65 to $70.
Now that sounds like a small amount of money per trip, but of course over time that does add up, especially for those who may not be able to put a lot of money together for those kind of trips. Is there any help for them?
Yeah, what we proposed is a fare equity solution for the community. For those that have fixed income or low income, what we're introducing is we are going to be purchasing a mobile ticketing app. And through that app, the individuals that cannot afford to pay all at once for a $36 or 30-day pass, they can pay $1 at a time. But once they get to $36, maybe that may be 2 weeks later or a week later, 3 weeks later, once they get to that $36 in that month, the rest of the rides are free. They essentially bought a 30-day unlimited pass.
So for the typical rider that would use this, I imagine, one two-way stop a day perhaps, so they would be spending $3 a day over the course of a month, they're looking at $60 or more. So you're looking at saving close to half that, in a sense?
Correct, yeah. The whole essence of having an unlimited pass is for those heavy users of transit, you're discounting that that pass for them to use it. It's more convenient for them as well. They just show their pass or swipe their pass and they're done. And it's a benefit for them. We don't necessarily want them paying for every single trip the $1.25 increase. We want them to be able to pay for an unlimited pass.
You had referenced in the meeting that you're expecting there will be some that will stop using the service simply because of the higher cost. How much is that baked into the expected revenue increase you'll get from this?
Yeah, we're expecting through the reports that we've read about fare increases, you're typically going to see a decrease in ridership. Now, there's a lot of factors that go into that decrease in ridership. It could be the economy, where the economy is at. It could be gas prices. However, with us not increasing the fares for such a long time and the value that we've provided our riders over the last 2 years with increased frequency, more later service at night, Sunday service, we believe that we can maintain our ridership at where it's at right now. However, the reports are reading are saying a 7.5% decrease in ridership if we increase fares to 25 cents.
So how much do you come out ahead then?
Yeah, so we are still expecting to come out ahead of $100,000. We've factored that into our increase in revenue. We're factoring a decrease in ridership, but with the additional revenue we're going to get from the fare increase, we'll still have an extra $100,000 in revenue next year for next year's budget.
In addition, you've proposed ending the Olive Route, a route that goes from Orlando Avenue area in Normal to the Walmart in Normal. Ridership has been low there. So what options are available for those who still want to use the service?
Yeah, so the individuals that live in Orlando Northbrook, they can use the Yellow Route. That route has 15 or 30-minute service throughout the day. It's a little bit more of a walk, obviously, but there's still service to those individuals and customers. And then their trip, if they're going to Walmart, for instance, most of the riders, customers from that area are going from Orlando Northbrook to Walmart. They can still take the Yellow Route, which will take them to Uptown Station, and get on the Red Route, which will take them to Walmart, and it's the same amount of time.
Are passengers generally more accepting of a longer walk or extra steps they have to take to get to the bus if they can get more frequency?
Yeah, generally for transit, if you provide more frequent service, people, transit users are more willing to walk to that service, especially when you give 15-minute service. Like I said, during the peak, the Yellow does have 15-minute service. The rest of the day, it's 30 minutes.
And how much are you saving by eliminating the Olive?
We're saving about $523,000 by eliminating that route. However, we are going to be using the money saved from that route to add frequency on the Lime Route from downtown Bloomington to Walmart, and then also on the Red Route from Uptown Station to Walmart and Normal. We're calling that the Red Express and Lime Express.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stogg with Isaac Thorne, General Manager of Connect Transit. How much is there a correlation between gas prices and ridership? Gas prices are as low as they've been in quite some time, under $2. Has that caused more people to drive their vehicles instead of taking the bus?
Yeah, typically low gas prices, more people will use their vehicles or own a vehicle than they will take public transit. And as the price increases to above $3 and gets to $4, a lot more people will use public transit because the simple economics of owning and operating a vehicle as opposed to taking public transit is much, much cheaper. I'm cautiously optimistic back in November when we saw a sharp decrease in gasoline prices. They dropped below $2 a gallon. They're up closer to $3, which usually is good for transit. And we have seen over the last few months, even in December, increases in ridership. Last month was up, I think, 7%. November was up 8.5%. And we're up almost 9% year to date over last December.
And we're now about a month into the federal government shutdown, and a sizable amount of your funding comes from the federal government. How much of a concern is that in the short term and potentially long term, as there's been no movement toward a resolution?
Yeah, short term, we're not concerned. I think if this continues 6-8 more months, that's when it does become concerning for us, not only from an operating budget standpoint, but also a capital budget. We are We have capital improvements we want to make. We can't do that without the federal funding. I'm sure we could find a way through our local capital account to pay for those expenses, but we don't want to have to do that. So I think short term we're fine, but as if this continues 6-8 months, then we'll have to look at other forms of funding, such as a short term line of credit or something of that nature.
And what are some of those capital improvements that you're relying on federal funding for?
Yeah, so we're about ready to issue a RFP to have solar infrastructure installed here at our maintenance facility for the arrival of electric buses in 2020. So we'll have solar panels on our maintenance facility that will reduce our energy costs here for the maintenance and administration building. We should have near zero cost, but also that infrastructure is important to reduce the cost of charging electric buses.
That was Connect Transit General Manager Isaac Thorne with GLT's Eric Stock. The agency plans to schedule community engagement sessions in the coming weeks to gather public feedback about the proposed rate hikes and route changes. It will hold a public hearing in March. The rate changes would take effect July 1st. As a matter of disclosure, GLT Program Director Mike McCurdy is the chair of the Connect Transit Board.
Support for GLT comes from the Central Illinois Regional Airport, encouraging travelers to support the local economy and enjoy a convenient airport experience, including free parking. CIRA says, don't travel before you travel. Fly local. Details and schedules at CIRA.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a report on the thankless, grinding job of a snowplow driver. Too many people are learning misconceptions about sexual assault through TV shows. That's according to members of Normal's Police Investigative Unit. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with Lieutenant Paul Smith and Detective Nicole Bruno about how sexual assault allegations play out in the courtroom. Bruno says the public views sex crimes as different from victims of other crimes and not in a good way.
You would never question the victim of a burglary or a robbery about what they were reporting, but it seems like what we've seen or what I've seen through some of the cases that I've investigated is that seems to be how those are viewed from the public. So they look at it as putting, you know, the victim on trial or questioning the actions that the victim did or saying that it didn't happen that way, whereas we don't see that rarely, if ever, in any other type of offense. So throughout investigating some of these and some of the outcomes at trial for the ones that went to trial, it was very concerning, you know, for us to notice that this was happening. And then even with law enforcement, the training that we've gotten on this topic has increased dramatically throughout the years, which is a good thing. Unfortunately, the public sometimes gets their education from TV shows where it's the stranger in the bush or a very violent situation like that, where it's more than likely somebody that the victim knows. You know, it could involve substances, intoxication. So I think really the reason, you know, we see the need to educate the public is because the public is who's going to make up our juries. So they're going to be the decision makers when they see cases like this. So it's important to educate them on the reality of what these cases look like. And then also, in turn, obviously, educate law enforcement, too, as we're the ones that are investigating it.
Right. So how do you see ways of educating?
You know, I think a lot of times education, especially nowadays, a lot of it is social media, public service announcements, and really just reaching out to your peer groups and having a discussion and starting a discussion on it is how we educate. You know, we don't obviously suggest you get your education from CSI when it comes to something like this, but actually coming to professionals who work in the field who have the direct knowledge would be better education for something like this.
To add to what Detective Bruno just said, I think that while we can certainly do education at the college level, sororities, fraternities, general public, we also have to start even younger than that. We are frankly seeing cases involving people in school, high schools. I think that if we start at that level, really reinforcing what we expect when those kids leave high school, move on to the military, move on to college, that we can then expect that they'll perform that way, and or that they've at least been trained and they understand the differences. It's not lost on me that you take that same age group and some kids go off to college and some go to the military, and we have problems in both of those environments with consent. So, you know, where do we go and how young do we go, I think, is a national conversation right now of, you know, do we train these kids in high school, junior high, so that they grow up with it and it becomes ingrained in them long before they ever see the first day at college or boot camp?
That's a really interesting strategy, is, you know, teaching the youth so that as generations progress, it becomes hopefully less and less of a problem. The other side of that is trying to focus on teaching those older generations who are more likely to be in a jury.
Absolutely. There's no doubt right now that you are going to see a very low representation of, you know, say 18 to 26-year-olds sitting a jury for many different reasons. They're in college, they're in the military, they're away, their names haven't made it into the database. Frankly, attorneys won't pick them out of that peer group. They'll pick more senior folks, people that are older, better educated, more life experiences. So we have to do both. I think, to your point, we need to start so that change starts happening at the younger ages. But we also have to figure out how to reach our juries that are currently seated and those that are being selected right now, so that they have something else to bounce against the TV show or the detective story that they see on TV, that they know this is real and that it happens, you know, here in Bloomington Normal or Central Illinois in our community.
We've talked a lot about these narratives that people see play out on TV shows and maybe in books or stories that they read. And maybe let's focus on some of those misconceptions that people might have about sexual assault. For one, the idea that if you knew the person beforehand, there's no way it can be sexual assault. If you're in a relationship with that person, there's no way it could be sexual assault. If you're married, you don't get raped by your husband or your wife. So can we address some of those misconceptions and how we work to educate the public to see that those aren't always true?
Yeah, I would say just educating them on what is sexual assault versus focusing on what it's not, which would be the misconceptions. To change somebody's perspective, I think, is sometimes very difficult on something, especially a topic like this. But we've heard everything from, well, if they were flirting at the bar beforehand, then it wasn't a sexual assault. Well, it turned into a sexual assault the minute there was no consent. So it doesn't matter what happened before that or what the actions were before. We need to specifically focus on what actually happened in the actual assault part of it, which is when consent went out the door. So I think, you know, again, just having conversations about what misconceptions there are and kind of looking deeper, I guess, why we're having these misconceptions, like where are they coming from? And I've noticed in some of the cases that I've worked, some of them are coming from the victim's friends and family. You know, they might have reported or told them about what happened, and they get questioned by their friends and family, those that are there to support them. And going back to kind of the misconceptions and misunderstandings, I had a friend of a victim who actually told me that she thought that the incident was more of a sexual assault and not a rape. So to hear that, again, as a friend, I thought, well, what do you think is the difference? And they had no idea what the definition was.
We hear stories of men saying that they're afraid to go out and talk to women because they're afraid they're going to be accused of rape. Can we get into the definition of what consent is?
So the way they define consent in the Illinois statutes is it reads as consent means a freely given agreement to the act of sexual penetration or sexual conduct in question. Lack of verbal or physical resistance or submission by the victim resulting from the use of force or threat of force by the accused shall not constitute consent. The manner of dress of the victim at the time of the offense shall not constitute consent. Any person who initially consents to sexual penetration or sexual conduct is not deemed to have consented to any sexual penetration or sexual conduct that occurs after he or she withdraws consent during the course of that sexual penetration or sexual conduct.
So just to, you know, to answer the question and incorporate that, there needs to be an agreement to the affirmative that both parties are moving forward in a consensual manner. And, you know, to use the word consensual to define consent, it seems logical, but the reality is that both parties have to agree that they're moving forward and that they're going to have, you know, whatever conduct or relationship they're having. And I think that, you know, most of the time, you know, we hear from people that say, well, nothing was said, so yeah, good to go. Or, well, that person was passed out, so no was never, she never said no, or he never said no. Well, those, obviously that person can't consent.
So let's move on to a different issue is the statute of limitations. Can we explain what the statute of limitations is and how that kind of plays out in a rape case?
The statute of limitations generally is the state legislature sets limitations on each crime where prosecution can be taken. In sexual cases, there have been several variations of the laws over, you know, the last two decades, from a very strict statute of limitations to, in some cases now, you know, children coming forward can, you know, cases can be taken up decades after they were ever sexually assaulted.
Delayed reporting is very common in these cases and therefore should never be an indication that something didn't happen, which we hear a lot. Well, if they waited or how come they didn't report it? I find that delayed reporting of this crime is very common. Some of the things that make it a little bit more difficult in the investigation when it is a delayed reported case to us is we lose a lot of physical evidence. So depending on how long the delay is, if it's months or years, sometimes even, we would lose that piece of physical evidence. So although it is very common, sometimes that makes the cases a little bit more difficult to investigate and therefore obviously then get to court.
What we tell folks is that's why that initial report is so important, and it's extremely hard for a victim sometimes to come forward with that. You know, the process is not easy on the victim regardless of what happens, but we're able to get to a point very quickly where we can put the victim back in control of the situation, and if they need to take some time and deal with it, once we've preserved that initial evidence, once we've preserved everything we can, then the impact on the case is much less, and we can give them time and allow them to move through it at their pace and allow them to get back into decision-making position. And that's, you know, why from our standpoint, we attempt to get them to a point where we can look at them and say, okay, what do you want to do with this, and where do we need to go? And sometimes that is, I'm not ready to deal with this. And we respect that. And then we, you know, if that person comes back a year later, we're still in a good place to help them.
That initial evidence collection that you're talking about, I'm assuming you're talking about rape kits?
Rape kits, clothing, photographs, text messages, you name it. I mean, we live in a digital age. You and I can walk out of here, and I guarantee you by the time I could get to my car, I'm going to show up on a camera system somewhere. Frankly, if I can get to that evidence before that's rewritten, I can prove that I walked into this building today. If you wait a year, that probably isn't there. And it becomes very critical in our cases that we're able to look at that point in time and determine what evidence is available, and it's different in every case.
Illinois has a historically great backlog of rape kits. Can you give voice to how that presents an issue?
I would say with the backlog, it not only presents an issue for us working the case, but also presents an issue when we're trying to promote this safe space for the victims that we want you to come forward and we're going to work these cases, and then they hear that it's going to take that long, that sometimes sends a message to them that their case might not be important, which is not the case at all. It's just, unfortunately, with the state of Illinois, it's not that they're not working them. It just doesn't, they don't have the resources to work the volume, I would say, that are coming in. So there's definitely a backlog especially now with the changes where every sexual assault kit does go to the lab. So that's obviously increased.
And you might not have these numbers, but is, like, what does a wait list look like?
Well, I can tell you, you know, in this county, it's not uncommon for it to definitely take more than 6 months to get DNA evidence back. In the most, you know, in the horrible cases, it's taken over a year or longer.
Rape kits are very important evidence mm-hmm. when in the courtroom, and when there's not concrete evidence present, it's even more difficult when it comes to a rape case.
We've seen it before where that's what a jury expects, or that's what people expect. They expect there to be a DNA available, especially if there was a sexual assault kit done. But that's not always the case, and that doesn't mean that there was no sexual assault. So
Normal Police Lieutenant Paul Smith and Detective Nicole Bruno speaking with GLT's Mary Cullen. Last year, the Normal Police Department announced Be the Change, a public awareness campaign aimed at ending sexual assault victim blaming by building strong, educated support systems. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Whenever a snowstorm hits, the first question most people have is, when is my street getting plowed? People have been asking that a lot over the last two weekends. GLT's Eric Stock talked to someone who usually has the answer. He joined a veteran snowplow driver who worked an extended overtime weekend shift to help make Bloomington routes drivable.
Bobby Potlett has been a driver for Bloomington Public Works for 25 years. He's been on the snow removal crew for the last 20. When he climbed into his dump truck with a snow plow in the front and a road saw in the back at 7 o'clock Saturday morning, Potlett had already been clearing roads for 5 hours. The winter storm warning still had 11 hours to go.
I can go home, you know, at any shift, but I try to stay as, you know, until I can. You know, we work three shifts or two shifts or whatever, and then you just go home. If you're tired, you're tired. You go home, you get you some rest, and if they need you, call you back in after the next shift.
They don't want drivers out there who are fatigued.
No, you definitely don't want that.
When I drive in weather like this, after about an hour, I've had enough. So how do you handle like 16 hours of driving through this?
You just get accustomed to it. You know, you gotta, you've done it for so long, it just comes natural. You just gotta know the snow, you know, like if you're driving in, if it's slick, like this is a wet snow, so it could be kind of a slick, slushy type situation. So you just kind of take your time and be safe with it.
I guess I'm afraid to ask, have you ever been involved in an accident?
No.
Really? Wow.
Been in a few ditches, but no.
Sure. That's reassuring. Of course, you probably never had to be interviewed while you're doing this. What's the most enjoyable part of it?
When it's all done and you get to go home.
I imagine, too, though, you're serving an essential function. As you said, it's an emergency function. Is there a certain amount of pride and a sense of responsibility that comes with that?
Oh, yeah. You know, we take pride in what we do. You know, we try to make it look good for the citizens, and that way everybody's happy, you know. So we try to do the best we can.
Now, are you able to sort of shut it off as you go home, or as you're driving back home, you're looking at all these roads thinking, okay, well, this was good. This could have been done better.
You kind of try to, it's a nature thing. You do that, but there's times that you're just like, I don't even want to think about it right now. I just want to get some rest, and then we'll address that when I come back in.
This hasn't been a terrible winter yet, but it hasn't been great these the last couple of weekends. Does that sort of take its toll when you have two pretty significant storms in a short amount of time?
It does. It comes down to the whole rest situation. You know, you just got to get yourself, you know, enough rest to where you can gear up for the next go around, because whether or not it's coming.
If you have to put in all this time and these storms have been on weekends, do you get to make up that time during the week? Or is this overtime, or how does that work?
Yeah, this is overtime for us.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah. Our shift's Monday through Friday from 7 to 3, so then anything after that is overtime.
And, of course, storms don't normally happen 7 to 3 Monday through Friday.
Not usually.
Poplett says as a snowplow driver, he's mostly self-taught. Snowstorms, as it turns out, are like snowflakes. No two are the same. He says training comes with experience.
You can get training, but being in it is about the best training you're going to get. And each snow and every snow event could be different. So you just learn as you go. There's really no way to prepare for it. You just get in and do what you can every time. Just try to, you know, learn each time as you go.
Is there ever like a whatever you do, don't do this or don't do that, or things that you sort of have to learn the hard way?
Yeah, you learn them, and you know sometimes they're a hard one to learn, but you learn them from the next go around. But you know you learn from your mistakes and you learn from the positive things too. So
anything that comes to mind when you tell someone starting as a tips or rules of thumb?
Take your time, you know, don't get in a hurry, and be safe. You know, that's the main thing, is you know just be safe for yourself and for everybody around you. It's just work at a good pace.
How fast can you typically go safely in a snowstorm like this?
Some people run different speeds. It's just, you know, they can do 20-25, just depends on how you feel with it.
It looks like we're doing about 30, but it seems comfortable.
Yeah, it's not too bad. Sometimes you got to go give it a little more because if the snow could be heavy.
As we pull into Heartland Hills subdivision on the southwest side of Bloomington, plow driver Bobby Potlett says visibility is okay despite occasional bursts of wind that push the mountains of snow back on the road, but he's grateful for daybreak.
When it's at night, you don't have no lights out here, so you're trying to find the road.
Right.
Because, you know, there's no curb, so when you're out here, it's just the end of, keep it between the ditches.
Daylight typically means more drivers sharing the road, which creates another layer of concern for the plow drivers.
Yeah, cars can't get up this hill. I mean,
Poblet says drivers getting stuck need help right away, and getting that help often slows snow removal.
It slows the process down quite a bit, you know, because, you know, they're in the way, you know, and you want to try to help them, but, you know, you got to try to get it all cleaned up, and just like that, you're getting cars stuck, and, you know, you try to do what you can to get around them to open up the road and get it salted so they're able to get out and get up the hill and get out of the situations that they're in.
Accidents do happen, and sometimes snowplow drivers are the cause. But Poplett warns the damaged mailboxes, which plow drivers are typically blamed for, are not always their fault.
Sometimes people think it's us that get the mailboxes. You know, sometimes the snow is just so heavy when it rolls off, it don't matter how slow you're going. If it's a wet, heavy snow, it just bowls them over like a bowling ball.
Another complaint this winter, what about all the fall leaves that were never picked up? First snow of the season came weeks before winter officially started, and Poplett says crews have been playing catch-up ever since.
It makes it a little harder on everybody because, you know, you just kind of want to get through seasons before the next one comes because, you know, it just complicates your job a little more. You want to get everything accomplished you can.
He says drivers can help snow crews by staggering their cars if they must park on the street, so plows can get in between each vehicle, or better yet, park in the driveway, even if it means getting blocked in by the plows.
You know, you get cars parked out there and we can't get it, so then we come back and then we plow your driveway shut again.
Yep. And that's probably a common complaint.
You know, you just kind of like wave to them like, don't be mad, I'm sorry.
Poplett says the work can be demanding, but he's single. It's less stressful for him than others with families at home. He says he takes as many extra shifts as he can to help coworkers.
You know, you try to take as much as you can for the simple fact that, you know, if I can, you know, I'd like for them to stay home with them. I've worked Christmases and stuff, so, you know, taking calls and stuff like that so people can be home with their families.
Poplett says the public largely seems to appreciate their efforts, even in cases where it might take a day or more for city plows to get to their neighborhood.
They're pretty much understanding, you know, and it's just like anybody else. You'd want your road done too, but, you know, they understand that we got to get the mains and secondaries open. And then, you know, when we can, if the bosses tell us, that's when we go in and take care of the rest of it.
Poplett's advice during bad weather, stay home unless you must be out.
If you don't have to, something you can prepare for, get everything you can or you need before you have to. And if you don't need to, stay home just to be safe.
That makes your job easier.
Right. It makes our job easier, and, you know, it's just safer for everybody. If I didn't have to be out in this, I'd be staying home and enjoying some time at home.
Last weekend's storm ended up being less severe than first feared. Bloomington Normal received about 3 inches of snow. While winds weren't as strong, the roads were mostly cleared by that afternoon. I'm Eric Stahl.
Some parts of western Illinois received close to 6 inches of snow last weekend. That pales in comparison to the foot or more some parts of the region received. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock and Mary Cullen, and thanks to Jeff Fritzen of the Normal Town Council. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page. We're at WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.